It is a sacred time, this, and a sacred place, this. It is a place for questions more profound than answers, vulnerability more powerful than strength, and a peace that can pass all understanding. It is a sacred time, this. Let us begin it together in song. In the center of our service, in the center of our lives, let us make room for life's quieter sides. You may use these first moments for lighting candles of memory and hope, or just sitting quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. Please join me in a spirit of prayer. Let us not be so filled with ourselves that we cannot forgive others their sins and foibles when we knew they meant better. And let us not be so empty of ourselves that we let others use our forgiveness as a license to behave badly. The balance between justice and mercy is always a dynamic balance, meant to empower the best kind of life within and around us. If our sense of justice is no more than punishment, it is a poor justice. And if our sense of forgiveness does no more than enable bad behavior, it is a poor forgiveness. Let us try to balance a rich sense of justice and an empowering kind of forgiveness, as though the quality of life both within and among us were shaped by them. Amen.
This is the third sermon I've done on a one-word theme. I'm planning to do one a month and developing a list of 36 themes, so we'll revisit each theme every 3 years. The themes may be only one word, but they don't seem to be simple. Forgiveness, perhaps especially within Western religions and Western culture, is very complicated. In fact, I would start with the heretical statement that forgiveness is not always a good thing. And the reason is that forgiveness suffers from a deep imbalance in Western religions and Western culture. And when it's unbalanced, it can be a very dangerous thing. That's not the way we're taught. The best-known story about forgiveness in the Bible is probably the prodigal son story, a parable of Jesus's. You know the story. A father had two sons. Their mother is never mentioned. And one of the sons demanded his full inheritance in advance. Now, that was legal under Jewish law. A son could do that. But if a son did it, he had no more claims on the family ever. The father had to come up with cash for half of all his property was worth. It probably meant he would have had to have sold things. It also meant that after the younger brother left, the father and the older brother had to work a lot harder to get the work done. The young brother squandered all the money on wine, women, song, and CDs. And he returned home to ask if his father would take him back, this time just as a servant, since he had forfeited all right to be taken back as a son. To the older brother's disgust, the father welcomed him home and threw a great feast to celebrate. He even slaughtered the fatted calf for the feast, the fatted calf that they had been fattening so that the father and the older brother, who had done all the work, would be able to celebrate with a feast at harvest time. That's the calf he slaughtered. Now, be honest. Most adults who hear the story side with the older brother. And they don't think it was right of the father to forgive the younger brother. It wasn't fair. Now, to see and feel just how sex-linked notions of forgiveness are, all you have to do, especially on Mother's Day, is make one small change in the story and make it a story about two sons and a mother. Suddenly, it changes everything. We expect the mother to forgive him. We expect the father to stand up for justice, but the mother to offer forgiveness, don't we? Forgiveness seems closer to a feminine trait than a masculine one, especially in Western culture. I think it might be interesting to ask trial lawyers whether, if they were defending the younger son, they would rather have a jury of all women or all men. I think forgiveness does seem to be a feminine trait in the West, and vengeance and justice seem associated with masculine traits. That's not the case in all religions. In Hinduism, Kali is a fierce, frightening, judging, and punishing goddess. And in Greek mythology, the goddess Dike, who's the goddess of justice on earth, is a goddess of absolutely ferocious justice with no forgiveness about her. So in other religions, goddesses can be fierce and gods can be more gentle, but not in Western religions. It's hard to think of stories, either from the Bible or in Christian history, of women who are really fearsome or men who are terribly forgiving. In the Bible, the traits seem deeply sex-linked. It's worth asking why, and I think the answer goes all the way back to God's birth. Now, if you've read your Bible, you may be wondering where it talks about God's birth, and there is no story of God's birth in the Bible. I mean the story that biblical scholars have discovered about where the ancient Hebrews got their idea of God, where their God came from, the birth of their God. And it has everything to do with our culture and with our notions of both forgiveness and justice. The Hebrew tribes were surrounded by people whose gods were nature deities. And almost always that means that the main deities are going to be female, as it's females who give birth and nurse and nurture. But the ancient Hebrews' god was not a nature god. He grew out of the idea of a tribal chief, one of their tribal chiefs. He didn't want to put you in touch with nature. He wanted to be obeyed. And he could be ferocious when he was disobeyed. Scholars have found that the biblical covenant between God and his chosen people, that's the "I will be your God and you will be my people," and the basic deal is you obey me and I'll protect you, you disobey me and I'll destroy you. That covenant was based on an ancient Hittite sovereignty treaty between a ruler and the people that he ruled. And God acted like a tribal chief throughout the Bible. It isn't about understanding or forgiveness. It's about obedience. When you think and when you find places in the Bible that are about understanding and forgiveness, they're almost always, all I can think of, from what they call wisdom literature, which is really the folk wisdom that wound up being put in the Bible. Proverbs, Ecclesiastes, the book of Job, the wonderful book of Job, or the work of some of the prophets. It's about obedience. It's hard to think of many good stories about forgiveness as opposed to protection for obedient believers, because there aren't many stories like that. Maybe that's why so many people find it odd or even wrong for the prodigal son's father to forgive him, but would expect his mother to. The psychologist Carl Jung has talked about our soul, our psyche. Psyche is the Greek word for soul, as divided into a masculine and a feminine style, and some of that feels helpful here. He called the masculine style the animus and the feminine style the anima. They act in different ways and they act in different directions. The animus, or the masculine style, tends to act outward. You could say it acts out, and that's close to. It can be a fierce protector of things like duty, obedience, and justice, things that Dike, the goddess, was in Greece, but now male gods are, and the male part of our psyche is in the West. When it's unbalanced, it can be very dangerous to others because it will insist on a kind of obedience and justice without any rounded appreciation for human nature or human frailties. Even the word animus is the root of the word animosity. It's that close to violence. The anima, or feminine style, is inward, and it seems to be the key in which forgiveness is played. But it also has to be balanced with a concern for what's fair, for justice. Unbalanced, it can be dangerous to us by endorsing abuse without insisting on justice or respect. I'd say that great religions are all trying to develop both. They're trying to develop our animus for its sensitivity to justice for wrongdoing, and our anima for its sensitivity for forgiveness and mercy. Justice and mercy. And the conflict is between justice that negates mercy and mercy that negates justice. And often in the history of Western religions, they've almost been that separate. You can think of a lot of stories of this. For either of them to be humane and safe, they have to be balanced, but we have to balance them because they don't come balanced for us in Western religions. Now, many Christian scholars like to jump in right here and say, yes, well, you see, the Jewish God was a God of judgment, but that's what Jesus brought. Jesus brought the God of forgiveness. Jews love it when Christian scholars say things like that. The Christian scholars are partly right and partly really wrong. For example, whereas it's hard to find clear stories teaching forgiveness in the Hebrew Scriptures, Jesus once told people that he expected them to forgive 70 times 7. That's a lot. He also said you shouldn't judge so that you won't be judged. So it sounds like he's emphasizing forgiveness over judgment. But it's an equally unbalanced kind of forgiveness in Christianity. It's just as unbalanced as the judgment was that caused so many lines to be written in Deuteronomy about all the disobedient people who need to be stoned to death. In Christianity, forgiveness too often has no component of justice to it. No holding others accountable to something like a social contract or a respectful relationship. And without that balance, forgiveness can be as dangerous to us as unbalanced justice can be dangerous to others. Jesus' saying we should forgive 70 times 7 has inspired at least one book by that name. I got curious, so I Googled it. It was for sale, used for a penny plus shipping. You're worth it. I didn't read the whole thing. I read parts of it. They're all stories, about a half a page each, of people forgiving others in every imaginable situation, and some situations that shouldn't even be imaginable. There's even the story of a man who had been badly physically abused by his father, sometimes beaten unconscious, until he finally ran away from home as a teenager. A few years later, he joined a church, and he told his story to the minister, and the minister insisted that he write to his father and beg for forgiveness for running away. That's unbalanced. It's also dangerous. This is the kind of forgiveness that can be demanded by a tribal chief. It goes back that far. A tribal chief can demand that whatever he does be forgiven because he has the right to do whatever he chooses. And your job is to obey. It's unhealthy, it's unbalanced, and it's wrong, and unfortunately, it's not rare. Mother Teresa, everyone's favorite saint, provided a memorable example of an unbalanced and, I think, a dangerous forgiveness. In a famous story, many of you know, when Union Carbide essentially hired her to do their PR after their chemical spill in Bhopal, India, had killed 3,800 people. They made a donation to her Sisters of Mercy charity and then flew her to Bhopal. When she landed, the media were there wanting to know what she advised following this horrible tragedy. She said, "Just forgive, forgive, forgive. It's not enough. This is a forgiveness that becomes an accomplice to corporate irresponsibility, a forgiveness that is the active enemy of justice, especially when the company had hired her." Other examples of forgiveness so unbalanced that it becomes dangerous are the ones you find in battered women shelters all over America. A majority of the battered women return to the men who beat them, probably not for the first time nor for the last. It's a tacit kind of forgiveness that becomes a license for abuse. And in Western religion, and this I think is probably true of all religions that I know of, this license to abuse seems granted only to husbands, not to wives. But in Western religions, it goes back to a story from the very beginning of the religion. Many of you will know the line if you were raised in very conservative religions, the line where St. Paul taught the early Christians that men, after all, are made in the image of God, while women were made in the image of men. That's the tribal chief again. Actually, where that comes from is the story in Genesis. The Hebrews were surrounded by nature deities, and what they took for their creation story was a creation story that only a goddess could have done. Only the nature goddesses can create everything out of themselves. They took the story and then applied it to a male god who creates everything from nothing. He creates men, so men are literally created in the image of the male god, and the women were created as his helpmate. That's where some of this comes from. In trying to sort through some of this forgiveness business, I went to my dictionary and found its first two definitions that were very helpful, and maybe they'll be helpful for you too. And they fit with the anima and animus and the history, I think, of Western religion and where it leaves us. The first definition is to excuse someone for a fault or an offense, to pardon someone. So it's the outward acting. The second definition, though, is inward. It's to renounce anger or resentment against someone, whether you excuse them or not. Ideally, you can do both, but they operate by different rules. The first kind of forgiveness, the outward, is only safe if the other person is in a mutually respectful relationship with you. If an abuser can't or won't come into respectful relationship, it's unwise and probably unsafe to forgive them because it won't be much more than permission to do it again, as tens of thousands of people have discovered the hard way. There has to be a social contract in order to forgive someone for bad behavior against you. Then it's a restorative kind of forgiveness, meant to restore a good relationship, whether a personal relationship or a societal one. There's actually my very favorite teaching on this is a little perverse. It's my very favorite. It's a proverb from the Hebrew Scriptures that shows by implication how fundamental that social contract is, although it doesn't sound quite that way when you first hear it. The proverb says, if your enemy is hungry, give him bread to eat. If he's thirsty, give him water to drink. So you will heap glowing coals on his head, and the Lord will reward you. Now, there's something weirdly delicious about this image of someone who's treated you badly and you're very decent to them, and it puts hot coals on their head, and God is pleased. There's something about that. The real meaning, though, is less bizarre and a whole lot more grown up than that translation sounds. The note at the bottom of the page says that this phrase, the hot coals, the glowing coals, really means a deep sense of shame and remorse. So if someone is in a relationship with you, a loving, a respectful relationship, a social relationship, and they behave badly to you and you don't return it in kind, if they have a conscience, they will probably feel a deep sense of shame and remorse, which may bring them back into proper relationship. So if the relationship's there, this can be a very grown-up, creative, and healthy thing to do. If it isn't there, then it's not safe or wise. Then you can't get the first kind of forgiveness. All you can hope for is the second kind, the inward kind. And I think we confuse these a lot. I have a story about this that I've told here before, but it seems worth telling again. First time I told this story, someone came through the line and said, I think that's about my mother. And I said, well, it doesn't seem likely. It was 15 years ago at a Unitarian summer camp in Wisconsin. And they said, it was about my mother. I have no idea. But this is the story. I was theme speaker at a Unitarian summer camp in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin, I think in 1992. There were about 500 adults there, and I didn't know any of them. But since I was visible, since I did the worship service every single morning, I was easy to spot, and people were coming up and talking to me during the week and sometimes sharing secrets or confessing. And the most memorable was this woman who asked me after lunch whether she could talk to me about something very painful and awful that she was going through. So we went out and sat on a bench under a tree, and she told me about what sounded like an absolutely horrible divorce she'd been through. It was just awful. It was painful to listen to the story. It was like a wound that was still completely raw. And I said, God, when did this happen? And she looked at me very sadly and said, 10 years ago. And she was still bleeding from it. Now, I don't know any of the details of the story. I don't even know if she told it right. Maybe he's a jerk. Maybe he just fell out of love with her. Maybe it wasn't as good a marriage as she thought. Maybe she didn't even notice whether he was happy. Maybe she was a jerk. I have no idea. It doesn't matter anymore. It just doesn't matter anymore. Because the relationship cannot be restored. There's no chance for the first kind of forgiveness to work. The only kind of forgiveness she can hope for is the second kind, the rejuvenative kind, where she can try to rejuvenate her own spirit by letting go of the hurt and the hate and moving on. She had a dream for her marriage, and it didn't come true. Not all dreams come true. But the tragedy is that all dreamers deserve the chance to dream again. And they can't do it if they're wrapped up in hate and hurt. So this kind of forgiveness, the rejuvenating kind, we don't do for others. It doesn't even have to involve others. We do it for ourselves. It's a decision to stop defining ourselves as a victim and to disempower the effect of the hurt and the hatred in our own souls. It's the second meaning of forgiveness that I think has the most religious and psychological power. The first is really a social contract. But the second can be powerful within our own psyche by cutting loose those things that have possessed us like demons. We shouldn't confuse the two. People don't have a right to demand forgiveness. That's a gift. We can give it, and we shouldn't give it if it will be likely to be used to hurt us or others, or understood as a sanction for bad behavior. You don't have to forgive the person. They may be long dead. They may have divorced you 10 years ago. You may never see them again. You don't have to forgive the person. But when the anger lives on like a demon possessing you, you're trapped, not your partner, not your parent. So do yourself a favor, not them. You can forgive within yourself what you would still hold the abuser responsible for. It doesn't even mean you ever want to be around them again. It means you're not going to keep defining yourself as a victim of an old story. It just seems important to say over again that this restorative forgiveness only works within a relationship of mutual trust or respect. Otherwise, it's just enabling, and it can be dangerous. There has to be transparency in a relationship, or it isn't safe. A mate who cheats in secret and then tries to defend and rationalize it by demanding his or her privacy is not to be trusted. That's not a respectful relationship. No forgiveness is due. But I want to go back to an earlier point that troubled me within 5 minutes after I first thought of it while I was writing this sermon. It's a point, one of the points left over from the prodigal son story, the one done with the mother rather than the father. It almost sounds like it's the mother's job to forgive, while we don't really expect it from the father. This could sound like it's the mother's job or women's jobs to teach men how to forgive. I wouldn't say that on a bet, especially on Mother's Day. It would just be assigning women another job. The other piece, though, from the story is that if women do most of the forgiving, where do they find forgiveness? Where do they find the understanding and the forgiveness they need for their own sense of human frailty? Maybe this is a good hint to the men and the children in their lives on Mother's Day. The hint that there's a woman living with you who may have been more forgiving of all of you than you've been. Now, where is she going to find the understanding and forgiveness she needs, not just today? And while the men and children are figuring out just how and where they might be more understanding, a final thought for the mothers. If you really are good at forgiving, for God's sakes, forgive yourselves. Just like justice needs an element of humanity in order to be a good thing, so does forgiveness need a sense of justice to be a good thing and a safe thing. So let us try to balance a rich sense of justice and an empowering kind of forgiveness, as though the quality of life both within and among us were shaped by them. For it is.